Welcome to the Songs of Note podcast, where we talk about the songs we love and the stories behind them. I'm your host, Ryan Gregg.
Hey, this is Ryan. Thank you so much for checking out the Songs of Note podcast. If you're here for the first time, welcome. This episode is so cool. I nerd out in this episode, guys. I got to talk to Jerry Cantrell from Alice in Chains today, and it was so awesome. Man, he's so cool. For people listening, Jerry Cantrell, you know, helped lead Alice in Chains, one of the biggest bands of the 90s. He's continued to write music ever since, and he's put out a new solo record called Brighton that is fantastic. It's great. I've been listening to it, and I just really, really enjoy it. If you are new to the show, be sure and subscribe so you don't miss other episodes. And if you're looking for a couple episodes to go back to, if you're a fan of grunge music or even 90s stuff, episode 74 we did on the podcast, it was about the Alice in Chains story as a whole. Episode 45 was about Nirvana. It was with Kurt Cobain biographer Charles R. Cross. That was one of my favorite episodes. I got to talk to former Pearl Jam drummer Dave Abbruzzese in episode number 50. And in episode number 41, I got to speak with lead singer of Everclear, Art Alexakis, and hear some of the stories behind some of their songs. So if you're interested, go back and check those episodes out and see what you think. Glad you're here. Hope you enjoy the episode. Here we go. Hey, Jerry.
Hey, Ryan.
How are you doing today?
Hey, what's going on?
Hey, I really appreciate you coming on the show to chat today. It's a real honor to talk with you.
Right on, brother. Good talking to you.
Awesome. Well, I got a couple questions for you. I'm thrilled to get to ask you some music questions. I'm calling you from Dallas. My first question is about your new record. I love the Brighton record, and I think the thing that first surprised me about the record was the title, and I was like, oh gosh, is this uplifting? Is this, you know, what are the themes going to be? So I'm curious for you, as you were stepping into writing this record, were you writing it from a specific place, and were there specific like themes you wanted to hit on?
I think I went about it, you know, similarly to how I approach other writing periods and recording processes. I go into it motivated and with a bunch of material that feels really good, that's kind of interesting, and I'm always surprised how it turns out, you know. Because it kind of forms itself, and some tracks just fall off the side and it starts to kind of take shape, and if you can kind of see that, it naturally kind of shapes itself. And so that was a really cool song. I thought it was a strong song and a cornerstone track on this body of work. And it kind of, you know, when I started listening to some of the feels of the other music and how all of this fit together, it just seemed like an appropriate title.
Well, it's such a great song as well. And it feels more upbeat than I was expecting for that specific song. Like, were you referencing musically any other songs, thinking I'd kind of like it to feel like this, or I kind of hope it does this kind of thing?
Not really. Mm. It's just blindly striking out in the dark and trying to hack your way through the wilderness with a group of friends that are along for the ride. And like I say, you're always surprised where you end up. You know, the clearing that you come out into. Holy, okay, wow. Never been here before.
Right.
That's pretty cool.
Nice.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, is that a different or more gratifying feeling now after doing it for a long time than you even had at the beginning, or has that feeling changed?
It's always a feeling of accomplishment and relief, you know, that you went through the process. You came out with something that you're really proud of and okay, cool. I can still do this, you know?
Yeah, I bet. I'm curious, like for you, when you're in the writing process and I'm assuming you have a bunch of ideas that you're working through, is there part of you that's trying to run it through the filter of, okay, I don't want to put out something that sounds too much like my past, but I don't want something to sound too much like this. Like, are you judging it by your history in the things that you want to put out, or are you just saying, forget it, I'm just going to put out the best song I can, and I'm trying not to think about that kind of stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I would tend to say that you don't really want to think about that stuff, but I can't deny that, you know, you're unaware of your history and the music that you've made. But that really is the key, is trying to put the blinders on and literally start with a blank chalkboard, you know, and even if they're ideas that you've collected from various times or wherever the idea comes from, when it springs into life, that's the time that it comes to be. There's a couple of tunes on this album that are riffs or ideas I've had around for a bit, but now is the time for them to actually come into the form that they're in now. I think you got to start clean, man. Mm-hmm. You have to start clean, and that's never really been an issue for me or the band, you know, Alice, and we're really good at okay, we did that, done that, don't need to do that again, you know. Mm. and it's more about where can you go now, you know.
That seems like a really healthy mindset too, to be able to keep moving forward and doing the next thing. You know, the song that I play so loud off the record is Atone, which is it just hits so hard. I love the song. And in as the highest compliment, in the best ways, it reminds me of the things that I love about Alice, but it also highlights the things that are unique to your solo project. And I'm curious, for that song, was that song gratifying to write, and what inspired it?
I'm glad it finally came to be in the form that it is, because I had the guitar riff and the chorus idea around forever, but that's a quarter of a song. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, you know, so the lyrics are all new. The middle section was new. The end was new. I mean, you know, I came up with three quarters of it at the end of 2019 when we started going through the demo process. But I remember I played that riff sitting in Tyler's studio, and he reacted to it immediately. He's like, "That's cool, man. We should do that." Huh. And I told him the same thing I just told you. It's like I've just never been able to crack the code on this one. I got like a riff and a chorus, and he's like, "Well, let's get into it." And I'm like, "Okay, cool." And that's what we came up with. And I think it's a good lesson to not give up on an idea. You know, I often reference filmmaking and you know, to explain the writing process and recording, you know. Not every film gets made, and sometimes it takes years for the right opportunity for an idea to actually come into being. And so, you know, ideas are like money in the bank. Mm. And I've had the demoing and songwriting bug since I was in my late teens. I've been doing that since. So I've got thousands of ideas or riffs or just little nuggets, you know, most of it's just little nuggets or riffs, you know, but I'm glad that one turned out the way that it did. And it also felt like an opener, you know, it felt like it
totally
should open the record. It's got that real kind of, it's got that really kind of loner against the world and the wilderness kind of vibe to it, you know? And the title begs the question, like, is the character, you know, have something, you know, like a wanted sign hanging at the post office with his picture on it, or is just something that, you know, that if you've ever had the feeling of like the world just being against you, even though there's nothing you did to really cause that to happen. You know,
right.
You know what I mean? So
yeah.
Like, could be either one of those or both or whatever. You know, I like to write it in kind of a little bit of a subconscious and collage-y kind of way. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times I'm surprised by where the story goes as well, but it's good. It's good. You know, the lyrics fit the song, and that's really what you're trying to do. The music really inspires the lyrical direction a lot of times. Mm. Like, well, what is this making me feel like? You know, or it happens to line up with something that you're feeling, thinking, or experiencing at the time. It's really, really interesting for me because it'll tell you what it wants to be if you listen to it, you know.
Hmm.
It'll tell you what it wants to be, and it'll also tell you what it doesn't want to be. Hmm. You know,
would you say that for Atone specifically, did you find yourself writing from an angle of this is a character, and I'm speaking about a situation, or do you find yourself writing more first person, or do you try not to do that?
Yeah, well, it's a combination of all of that. I think for, you know, if you're trying to put emotion into a song, it's got to,
yeah,
it's got to spring from you. It's got to spring from you.
Right.
And, you know, we're all human, so we all share experiences and emotions and feelings and situations. So, you know, you reflect back something that someone else can totally relate to. So, so obviously you start from a personal perspective, but oftentimes, you know, it's cool to throw on the costume of character too. You know,
I would think that would be freeing in the fact that you can take on a lot of new lyrical ideas without being confined to just your own personal experience. Is that what you found?
Yeah, well, you know, like you know, both are useful approaches to writing. For it to ring true emotionally, it's got to come from you personally. You know what I mean? So that's different. But you know how you tell that story doesn't have to be all you. And you know, a lot of the best songs I've written are not about me. Mm. They're about other people, you know, or other situations. So you know, or looking through the eyes of somebody else. You know,
I love that. Well, I've read a number of interviews with you and listened to some interviews, and I think that the thing that I am most, I guess, surprised by, as somebody who loves your music and loves that it's heavy, is the level of love you have for Elton John and his work, and it is incredible. And I love the albums that I've heard you talk about from him. Like when the thing I was listening to, you knew his band members. You were listing off, you know, who was in his lineup at the time. And I know he played on the Alice song, Black Gives Way to Blue, and I know you covered Goodbye from his record on your latest album, Brighten It. I'd love to hear what does Elton John mean to you as far as like your universe? Like how big a deal is he in your world?
Yeah, he was like one of the first artists when I actually started to open my mind and get turned on to music. You know, he was one of the first ones that struck me really hard, you know, when everybody, I guess all musicians, have that moment with an artist or with a group of artists at a time in their life. And something clicks on and you're like, and you make the connection of like, man, that's fucking cool. I would totally love to do that. You know, like if I could do something in my life, you know, like,
yeah,
that looks pretty good. Strap on a guitar and get in front of a bunch of people and rock out. That looks pretty good to me. So, he was one of those artists. And, you know, although, you know, he's obviously a piano player, he had a pretty rocking band, you know, and, you know, David Johnstone is one of my favorite guitar players of all time and played some amazing guitar, throughout his career. And they're still playing together, you know? And, you know, I also got the sense of a band, even though, you know, the focus was on Elton, you know, it's a band, you know, and also the teamwork of a writing duo, you know, like, Bernie Taupin writing the lyrics and Elton writing the music and the melodies, you know, so I got that too, you know, and what it meant to write your own songs. Even though maybe I didn't grasp everything about it, because it was, you know, what am I, 9, 10 years old when I started, you know, like kind of reacting to that music.
Mm.
But it's funny, you know. I've been really lucky but I don't think that's unusual or like, you know, I don't think it's unusual or you know, a rare thing. I think if something speaks to you and yeah, you should give everything you can to it and follow it, you know. Mm. And I was lucky enough to do that, and I've always been in love with music, and I just wanted to figure out any way I could to constantly be listening to it, playing it, writing it, and be a part of it, you know, be a part of music history, you know.
That's awesome. I was listening to his Madman Across the Water record earlier today. I was cranking Leave On, and I was like, man, that song's so good. And then it came to the Goodbye song, and I was interesting hearing his version and then listening to your version. I love them both so much, and I'm curious, why was that the song that you chose? It's a beautiful song, and I'm curious, why'd you want to record that one?
Yeah, it was kind of, you know, about halfway through the process of writing, I did a couple of live shows with a bunch of the musicians that it looked like I was going to work with on this record, and we got on a stage and played a bunch of boggy stuff and Degradation Trip music, and I hadn't played any of that stuff in a long time, as well as some Alice tunes and a couple of covers, and Goodbye was one of them, and we closed both nights with that song, and it's just a song that I've always dug. It's a great way to close the record or close the show, because it's in the title, you know, Goodbye.
Yeah, that's perfect.
But also it's so potent for like a 2-minute song. There's so much in it, you know, so much emotion. And I always dug the tune, and it wasn't intended to be on the record. We got to kind of the end of the recording process, and I had 8 songs that fit together as a body of work and made a really good record. But I thought I need to write one more, you know, and all I had was stuff that felt like a different record. It didn't feel like this record, the other stuff that I had kind of come up with during the writing process. So I'm like, we got to write another tune. And Tyler suggested, you know, why don't you record Goodbye, man? You love that tune. Mm. It totally fits with this body of work, and we've already played it before. So I'm like, yeah, let's give it a shot. So we recorded it. And I did a demo. I sent it over to Elton just to get his blessing on it, and he really dug it, you know. And sent it over to David Johnstone too the next day, and he liked it too. And that was enough for me. So
man,
it's kind of a I didn't plan it for that to be the case. It just ended up being a special thing that happened, and ended up closing the record. And it also mirrors Madman Across the Water, and the fact that it closes his record, which is a 9-song album as well, and that wasn't intended either, but it's just kind of one of those happy accidents. It's my album's a 9-song record, and it closes that record like it does on Madman.
It's interesting. I'm curious if you have had this same feeling for me, as you know, someone who loved music in my teens, and now in my 40s, I'm still in love with the songs that I first heard as a teenager, but they mean something different, and they come back around. And, you know, first time I heard it, I was a teenager, and the second time I'm, you know, thinking through it, or not, you know, my experience, the memory is of my 20s or whatever, in your different stages of your life. And for you, that song Goodbye will forever be changed, I would think, in that now you've covered it and you had that experience with him. And that seems like that'd be a really cool memory to be able to take with you and connect to that song forever. Is that right?
Well, that's why it's on the record.
That's,
you know,
cool.
Music is music's really trippy, man. You know, it's storytelling and celebration and also a way to process grief and pain. It's a shared experience as much as language, and it's been with us as long as I'm sure we could have been able to speak, and maybe even longer, who knows. But it's interesting that you point that out, that good songs will go with you throughout your life, and like your perspective may change.
Mm-hmm.
If the song, maybe some layers or levels to a song might come into focus it to you later in life, like they, in a different way than they do early in life. And I think the important thing, a lot of my favorite stuff is stuff that's just not like so instantly just, you know, captivating and then kind of disposable. It's like stuff that you get more out of it the more you listen to it. You know, there's more layers and depth to it, you know, and I've always been drawn to bands and songs that have that quality, and I've tried to write songs with that quality, you know.
I love that. I love that analogy. Gee, that makes me think of like this is very specific, but I remember it being younger, being like in my 20s, and being like, I'm gonna like this. I'm gonna start drinking coffee, and I was like, I don't really like it right now, but I kind of want to be a coffee drinker. And I remember having the same, like a similar feeling around some of my favorite musicians and artists. Like my initial reaction was not positive, but there was enough there that I was like, no, I'm hanging on.
Yeah, yeah.
And that they became some of my very favorite bands. And that's interesting to hear you say that. It made me think that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, three records that I'll give you three examples of three records that I love and three bands that I love. Nirvana, Bleach, I didn't like it when I first heard it.
Interesting.
It took me a little while to get it, and then after it came into focus, it didn't take long, but it wasn't an instant love, you know. And then I grew to, this is fucking badass, you know. Appetite for Destruction is a record like that.
Oh.
I didn't get the Hoopla right off the bat. It didn't come into focus for me, and it took a couple of weeks of listening to that record. And then I think one night I might have like just been kind of alone and listened to it, and like, you know, I made a decision. I'm gonna go through this record one more time, and if I still feel the same way about it, I'm gonna throw it out the window, and I'm never gonna listen to it again. And I got all the way to Rocket Queen, and when Duff starts that bass riff and that fucking rumble, it all clicked into fucking focus. And
made sense.
I'm like, oh my god, this is fucking badass. And then it was one of my favorite records of all time. A lot of bands and a lot of songs and a lot of films even are stuff that doesn't maybe hit me right away, but it's intriguing enough to keep at it until
right.
you get it.
Right.
You know? Yeah.
And then
yeah.
I think when you do get it, you're like the advocate for it. You're like, oh my gosh, this is the best thing in the world. You got to check it out.
Yeah. In my life, I'm notoriously a late bloomer. Mm. I've always been a late bloomer. I've always come to stuff well after the fact that everybody else seems to be fucking on board with it. Maybe a late starter, but I'm a strong finisher.
There you go. There you go.
I'll stick with something, you know, for a long time. So
right.
Rage Against the Machine's first record was like that, too. It took me a couple of weeks until the horizon tilted straight for me. I'm like, okay, I get it.
This okay.
badass. You know? Yeah. So those are three examples. There's many more, you know, but those are three really huge records and important records in rock history, and I didn't get them right away. They didn't speak to me right away until I invested a little time in them, you know.
That's super interesting. And I think about, like, for me, like when I hear a live song by a band, and I may not have loved the song on the record, but once I hear it live and I love it, I hear it differently on the record. And that was my experience with Bleach. It was like, oh yeah, I kind of felt the same thing. I kind of liked it. It wasn't until I heard the other stuff and I was like, oh, that's what they're doing. Their sound just isn't quite caught up to what
sure.
their, I don't know, potential is or something. Interesting. I'm curious on the song Siren Song off the new record. It is another song that I really love it. I love the slow tempo of it. Do you remember writing that song and kind of the thoughts you had in mind as far as, you know, was it intended to be a slow build, or what were the things that you were hoping to communicate in that song musically?
It definitely had a feel. It's almost related in a way. I think a tone and Siren are kind of bookends. They're kind of bookend songs. They have nothing to do with one another lyrically or musically, but they're connected. Side one and side two, side A and side B on the record. They seem connected, and they tell a story that's got that kind of Wild West, like with the tone, like a loner out in the wilderness, you know. I think everybody's had the experience of, you know, you take a personal feeling towards somebody, you know, that is kind of magical or you know, maybe a relationship that you've had that is a nourishing good thing, no matter if it ever never was consummated or whatever, and it's something you can carry through your life through the best of it and the worst of it, you know.
That's totally right. Well, I love that, and I'm just loving the record. So for people listening, that the record is Brighton. I'm curious about you when talking about Elton John being an influence, and because the thing that when I heard Alice in Chains Unplugged, the thing that jumped out to me not only was the songwriting was more in your face and like, oh my gosh, these songs are incredible, but the harmonies were way more apparent. That like you feel it in the live, in the recorded versions, obviously, but it was showcased in the unplugged version. And when I have listened back over and over, the thing I kept comparing it to for me were like early Beatles recordings, like even the BBC. There's like the song called "Soldier of Love" or "This Boy," and those are nothing at all like Alice songs. But the way that Lennon and McCartney would blend their voices to where I couldn't tell where the harmony was starting and the lead was ending, I found myself thinking, man, is Alice in Chains doing harmonies on that level, and they just put heavy, heavy rock on top of it? Would you, I mean, I'm just curious what your thoughts are on that. Is that at all what you would say, or not? Not really.
Yeah, you know, when you're in that sort of an environment, that really lays bare what the song is about and the bare bones and the mechanics of it, because you take away the sonic wall of what we are, and that's, you know, that's pretty significant, you know.
and it's
intended to be that, and that vocal work and the harmony is there within that setting. But when you're just sitting there with a couple of acoustic guitars, there's nothing to hide behind.
Right.
So that's always interesting to me. That's a sign of a really good song, you know. And you know, I'm a huge Beatles fan, and I've always loved bands that have had more than one strong voice.
Yeah.
And I also love bands that have a sound where you can't really tell who's singing what. It makes
right.
it a bigger thing than just the individual parts. And Lane and I were always fans of that, and we kind of developed the language. You know, one of the highest compliments we ever received, and I still cite it today because I get a kick out of it. But one of the early reviews of us called us the Satanic Everly Brothers, and I always dug that, you know, and because that's a high compliment, you know. And any band, you know, that is known by that, Everly Brothers, Simon and Garfunkel, right. The Eagles,
yeah.
Fleetwood Mac,
yeah.
You know, the Beatles, uh-huh. the Eagles. I mean, multiple voices that create like a bigger thing,
right.
You know, where the individuals kind of the edges of the individuals kind of fade
blurred.
Away and they
yeah.
blend into a bigger thing. That's cool to me.
Yeah,
that's a really magical thing.
And
it takes, you know, it takes some dedication to be good at that, you know.
Do you remember, I'm thinking of like songs like Rooster, like do you remember the feeling of like the first time you and Lane clicked on like, oh, we can do that, we can do the harmony thing? Like do you remember any moments like that they clicked and you're like, oh, I can't believe that we're making that sound?
Yeah, I think from the beginning we started working at that. You know, obviously, you know, in the early years, I was more concerned with you know, playing guitar, writing songs, and singing back, and just piping up and singing backups. You know, and you know, when you got somebody that's as unique and powerful and intuitive as Lane was, you know, there was no desire for me to stand up there and sing, because that guy's got it covered. You know, he also gave me, since I did sing a lot of harmony with him and we were the only two singing members, it's something, you know, I would demo songs and I would sing things and sing harmonies and stuff like that, and he's like, man, you should do more of that, you
oh,
know.
That's cool.
A lot of these songs are yours, and you know, you're plenty good enough to do it, just gotta reps in and stand up there and do it. And so he gave me, you know, on Sap, you could hear me start stepping out front a little bit,
yep.
you know, and
yep.
Wood and in Dirt, Down in a Hole, and you know, that just kind of continued record by record. And I always appreciate the support that he gave me as a singer. And you know, I also remember that same thing back to him as a, you know, he wanted to learn to play guitar, you know, and he wrote two or three of the coolest tunes we ever did, Hate to Feel and Love Hate, Hate to Feel and Angry Chair on guitar, and you know, and you know, but that's being in a band, you know.
I love that. I mean, that is so cool. Well, I don't know if you remember, but is there, like, do you happen to remember where you were or what you were doing when you were writing Rooster? I don't know if like anything comes to mind, but sometimes I'm curious if the moment jumps back to you, like, I was here strumming on a guitar. Is there any thoughts on writing that one?
Yeah, I was actually staying in West Seattle with Susan Silver and Chris Cornell at their house, and
wow.
they had a little guest room, and I had my little four track with me, and I remember it was a really small little room. I think it was like a converted closet or something like that, but it had a window looking out at the Puget Sound, and I stayed up all night and I wrote that song. And when Susan got up in the morning, I played it for her, and I remember being really moved by it. And I obviously, was pretty, you know, it's a pretty emotional tune, and I was really proud of that. But yeah,
man, that's amazing. I love that. I'm curious, like, what did that song mean to your dad when you played it for him? Was that emotional for him? I mean, I can't imagine what that must have meant.
Yeah, of course. I spent most of my school years growing up with my mother and my grandmother, and so we hadn't really spent a whole lot of time together for a number of years. So I was becoming a man, and I kind of just put myself in his shoes and tried to understand his life a little bit and what he'd been through and to answer some of the questions, you know, that I may have had. I think he really appreciated that song and it's something he's still proud of today.
Man, that's incredible. Well, you mentioned Wood a second ago. I've always wondered the intro to Wood that starts with that low bass. Like, did y'all start writing the song like that, or did you work backwards? Did you have like the middle part and then you worked into, let's do that for the intro? Do you remember how that song was recorded?
Yeah, I mean, Cameron Crowe asked us to do a song for
singles.
Write a song for singles.
Yeah.
I had that bass riff, you know, and I just kind of did a demo of the song and sent it to him. He sent it back to me recently. It was pretty trippy to hear that crappy four track demo. And it's pretty much in the same shape that it is. I think maybe that end vamp wasn't there on the original demo, but the riff, the bass riff and the vocals and the guitar chords and stuff are pretty true to how it ended up being. But yeah, he asked us to do a tune. I did a demo and then we recorded that song for that movie. Mm. It's not completely about Andrew Wood, but that song was inspired in part by Andy Wood. We really dug that song. And even though it sounds a little bit different and was recorded in a different session, we added it to Dirt, you know.
Man, it is. That's how I was introduced to you guys, which I'm sure a ton of people were in that way. But it's just so good. Man, Jerry, I just really appreciate you being willing to come and chat and share stories about your songs. And I'm such a fan, and I'm grateful for your time and for the music that you've made. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thanks for listening, man. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the Songs of Note podcast. Be sure and subscribe so you don't miss an episode. See you next time.